You're listening to Horus the Avenger, and this is Horus the Avenger's Follow the White Rabbit, exclusive production of WhiteRabbitRadio.net. And this week we are doing our second of the back-to-back specials for the White Man March, or as we call it around here, the March of the White Rabbits, which happens about every single day. Well, today we have two special guests on, our normal special guest, Truck Roy, and also Minnie Irva, or Laura, some of you know her by. Are you there, Minnie?
Yes, I am.
Things are going gangbusters at your place, aren't they?
Yeah, fantastic. We've been extremely busy with getting all the banners sent out and flyers and stickers for the White Man March on March 15th.
Yeah, you got them all out. And I know there's a great many that have emailed me, or at least I don't know an actual number of what we'll see that are actually making their own. Have you been contacted by a lot of people just making their own? I know you were in charge of sending out ones that were pre-made, but...
Yes, indeed. There has been a lot of people that have also contacted me with regards to, you know, the slogans that they should use and such. So I'm sure there will be many, many more above and beyond what we have posted out.
Well, that should be fascinating. I can't wait to see it. I just realized not long ago that it was on a Saturday. I didn't even realize that it was on a Saturday. So it should be rather interesting. Truck Roy, you want to add anything?
Yeah, well, we did the show last week talking about the White Man March, and if for someone that did not catch that, I think we probably ought to clarify a little bit, because I was a bit confused when I heard White Man March. I thought there was a big march going on somewhere, but it's kind of a play on words. It's going to be the month of March, and everybody's doing a little activism.
Yes, it is. It's a day of activism. It's not a, for the listeners, this is not a protest. It's not something that there's an actual march or a protest. It's just a day of free speech activism and that type of thing all over the place. Although there are no rules, I guess you could, in your particular area, stand on a street corner with some sign. I'm guessing we'll have Jimmy Marr out there with the bagpipes out there in Oregon, as they say. And, well, that should be interesting. And who knows what else is gonna go on out there, but Minnie's been in charge of getting out the signs, getting out some pre-made banners and all kinds of wonderful activities like that. I don't want you to tell the audience how far and wide you sent them, but I know from the emails I get, this pretty much is all over Western civilization, is it not?
Indeed, it is, and they have been going out to many white countries, Australia, England, and Sweden. So it will be, and actually I saw recently, on a Facebook page from Renegade that, there was even some stickers in Jerusalem.
Well, I didn't see that. Great. I haven't seen that yet, but nothing would surprise me. This stuff is all over the place. I know we've been contacted by groups all over the place. Most of them are making their signs, obviously. There's a good percentage that are making their own, which are, of course, there are no rules other than play by the rules, play by the laws of the area. But there are no other rules. I know this has been keeping you very, very busy with all these particular, it's a great deal of work getting stuff like this together and putting it together and sending it out and all kinds of fascinating stuff going on. Anything else you want to add, Truck?
Well, I'd just be curious to get Laura's input on what she, because last week we talked with the guy from Renegade Radio, Kyle, and he had some neat ideas. I really was interested in them, you know, it's not a march, but if you want to do a flash mob or a flash march somewhere and then have somebody standing off this side with a camera or something, and you can be, you know, there and done in a couple minutes and get some neat photos up on social media, there's nothing wrong with doing that. I'm kind of curious, what kind of ideas are you guys thinking about doing locally where you are, Laura?
Well, Chuck, that is exactly, that's what's so exciting about this event is that, so many people are going to get out there and do different things and that's all that they need to do is get a picture of it. And if they're not, keen on sticking around with the sign, that the picture is worth 1,000 words. And I was actually speaking with Johnny Mantraseed, just yesterday and he gave me a great, tip about, tracking, what happens on March 15th. And with Twitter, a lot of people do the hashtags, but he recently found out that if you don't use the hashtag, you can search a lot more, you know, from conversations or people. And he actually quoted several people that he had seen conversations about your billboard in Arkansas just recently. Lots of people driving past, taking pictures, and then you know, tweeting about it. So. That is going to be a huge thing on March 15th for everyone to collate the information of you know, what's happening and what activism they've done.
Yeah, they're talking about the billboard in Arkansas. We don't know whose billboard that is, actually.
Yeah, that's not my billboard, but yeah.
It isn't your area.
It isn't my town. And you know, my buddy was driving by it the other day, and he says there were some people parked on the side of the road, and a guy was standing there giving a thumbs up while his wife was taking a picture of him in front of the billboard. So it's definitely attracting some attention. But
it's a tourist attraction. Whoever put that up, they should pay them.
Yeah.
I know that there's a lot of activity in that area of Arkansas, so a lot of people are wondering exactly what's going to go on in that area March 15th, because obviously if you have someone putting up a hard sign and paying a year ahead of time or month to month to put that up, well, then you have another, you know, obviously there's going to be interesting things going on that day, and it should be interesting to see what Truck Roy does.
Well, as I mentioned on the last show, you know, one of the things is I hate to overpromise and underproduce. I like to kind of surprise people and do it the other way around.
Yeah, you're better off doing that.
Right, and you know, our newspaper kind of was front-running us by printing up an article about the upcoming White Man March, and it's going to be tough to surprise anybody. But I think, you know, even if you can just get out and get one little sign up and get that picture up on social media, I think what's going to make this event a success is the fact that on that same day, at that same time, it's going to be happening in so many other different places. So even if you don't do anything spectacular in your area, the fact that this is a cooperative effort all over the U.S., maybe all over the world, I think it's going to be really, really big.
Yeah, and of course, you know, you can always send in. I know there's several different parties that aren't on Twitter, won't have access to Twitter, but they do have email access, and they're sending stuff into us, or they're posting stuff for me to retweet on Twitter and stuff like that. That'll be all operational, as well as the White Man March website, whitemanmarch.com. I know Twitter is pretty much a staple on smartphones these days, so, you know, there's a variety of different ways. And like Laura said, you don't have to use hashtags, but I would use a hashtag. I would do a combination of things.
It wasn't so much that, it was the searching, like as in if we're posting stuff, then I would agree. But it was a side note to say that if you're searching for other people who are just talking about white genocide or talking about a sign that they saw, then they're not necessarily going to hashtag it.
You're right. You're 100% right. Yeah. So if you're doing a search on Twitter and you search for White Man March, you're going to get something probably a lot broader than just the hashtag. Yeah. I agree with that.
Okay. So it'll be really great to follow, and we're really wanting to get everyone to get pictures of their activism so that we can collate it together and put it out there. You know, maybe creating a website as well, like about white genocide activism on every day. I mean, it's not just March 15th. This is a crime that is being committed, and it's something we all need to stand up and fight against every day.
Yeah, that's something we look to do at White Rabbit Radio, is do something or encourage something to do every single day. And of course, you know, it takes a lot of people to actually pull that off. But I think these days we have something going on every day. It's just a matter of exposing it over and over again to the planet. I know, White Genocide Project is updating all the time these days, as well as I'm looking at whitemanmarch.com, which is an exclusive website for the march, and there's all kinds of stuff going on there. But that's something we're working toward, no doubt about that.
Absolutely. Well, it's, you know, it's, when it's, you're facing it every day, and you walk out around your local towns, and you're seeing the amount of, you know, the non-whites that you're having to force to live around. It makes you want to do something about it.
Yeah. Well, I know that's 100% right. There's more and more people becoming aware that there's a problem in this dysfunctional relationship we have with our dear elites.
Yes.
who want to pull the open borders, forced assimilation, forced integration, and, you know, then tell us about our inevitable brown future and magazine covers all the time. You know, this wonderful dysfunctional relationship we have, what we call it, the relationship between the white rabbits and the pink rabbits, you know, rabbits that look like us and have no loyalty to us. And it's becoming more and more obvious to the average person that there's something wrong, and we have the solution. We have the answers.
Well, Horace, I was talking to you earlier this week about a situation in my local area where that was really driven home to me, because it's just like, you know, we talk about it, these elites, and, you know, you think Rockefellers, Rothschilds, all these guys, but, you know, your local multimillionaire running a business here, you know, and I had a situation with one of those guys earlier this week where, you know, this guy had been my buddy, everything, and then all of a sudden, you know, he decides that I'm a little too politically incorrect for him. And he doesn't care the fact that he's employing, you know, all these Mexicans and everything like that. He really has no loyalty at all to his own people, that are especially the working blue class, blue collar people. And so it seems like, I don't know if he was born that way or what, or, you know, they come from these kind of little southern elite families or whatever, but they just really don't care who works in their factories, whether they're black, brown, yellow, whatever, and the only thing they seem to be loyal to is money. And, you know, these guys are not Jewish, but they sure act that way. So, you know, it's something from your show that I was really taking home. Getting back to the White Man March, when we get down to these different areas where we're going to be doing stuff, I always was thinking it would be neat to hit local landmarks. You know, if I was in Chicago, maybe go down to the fountains by Chicago, you know. And again, you only have to be there for a minute to get that photograph, but, you know, you get those recognizable landmarks around your area and hold up your sign there.
Yeah, I was thinking of various things like that too. Although, so some of the big landmarks I want to do, you'd have to drive, or at least I would have to drive quite a ways, but others, you know, I would say that's a good idea. Go to the biggest landmark you can legally walk around with a sign or put a sign up, and that would be pretty funny because, you know, if you had a picture of, you know, what's, well, some of these big political landmarks in Washington, if you had a picture of it, you know, in front of Abe Lincoln and whatnot, it'd be more interesting than your average street corner, obviously.
Well, find your local Martin Luther King Street and put it up next to that.
There you go.
Because there's one of those in every town.
Yeah, there is. You got that right. Well.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Laura, it was Laura Minnie Irva, as she's known to Bucksters. It was very good talking with you. I wanted to have you on for a few minutes. I know you're jam packed, busy with all the stuff going on. You've done a great deal of work, and we really appreciate the work you've done to help make this thing come off without a hitch.
And so thank you. I certainly would like to thank Kyle and the team from Renegade Radio for taking the initiative to do this, because they are the ones that are the real champions in this, because they got out there and they got it organized, fundraised for it, had the banners made, and have driven this the whole way. So I'm certainly very honored to be a part of it.
Yeah, and for those listeners that don't know, you can listen to the previous File of the White Rabbit, the one from last week, and we have Kyle from Renegade Broadcasting on, and he has done a god-awful amount of work on this thing. And we appreciate him, and we appreciate Minnie getting the stuff out there and playing her role behind the scenes and all the stuff she's done to move the Bugsters into line for the White Man March all across the
awesome.
Planet. But Minnie,
well,
we'll be talking. Okay.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, and we'll be talking with you again soon. We appreciate the work.
Sounds great. Thank you.
And again, we really appreciate having Minnie on the show and all the work she's done, as well as Kyle and those guys over at Renegade Broadcasting. They've all done a tremendous amount of work, and we're interested to see the white man march and what all goes on. And this type of thing, I can give you a warning, it probably will take 2 to 3 weeks afterwards just to figure out what all went on. Even though we're going to be getting the emails and the tweets and everything else. So it should be pretty exciting. I think it's going to be interesting. I've never quite seen anything quite like it, because this is the first pro-white open system style activism, you know, which is what we promote. Do what you can, you know, think locally or stay locally, act locally, but think globally, and do what you can where you can. It doesn't matter whether it's on a computer or on a street corner or whatever it is.
Well, and you mentioned on the computer, Horace, and I think the key thing is there is that you do something. And a lot of times when we hear from people like Minnie Irva or Kyle, you know, I know the average listeners out there are like, wow, these guys are really, and they are, they're busting their butts, and they're getting a lot done. But don't let that intimidate you and say, well, I can't do that much. Just do something. Just do one little thing. And, you know, a big part of it is the work that goes on the computer. The guys that do all the heavy lifting and the legwork over at Bob's sites are guys that are posting on YouTube videos and stuff. And it's not glamorous. It's not sexy. But it is critical, critical work. And a big thanks to all you guys out there who work behind the scenes. No one ever sees you, but you're the ones that make the things like the White Man March successful.
Yeah, well, that's what's getting out a message online is what's got us this far. And I've already said, if you own the television, you own the internet, you're going to own the streets. Before you ever hear rap music coming up and down your street, you're going to hear that new song on the internet or on MTV. That's just the way this stuff works. The tail wags the dog. The social media, you know, I mean, it's one thing to be running around on the internet, surfing around or just using it as a toy, but it is a serious tool. And we have these massive media platforms vis-a-vis these websites that can be used to direct a consistent message into the population. We've proven that. We have actually proven that. And of course, it only grows from here. It only gets bigger. But I've always told people that was always the biggest complaint. Who's going to be out on the street? I said, first we'll own the net, then we'll own the streets. One begets the other. It's kind of like, you know, why am I not hearing rap music bouncing up and down my street? Probably because you didn't hear it on MTV yet, you know. Once you start hearing it all over the place on MTV, then you're going to hear it on the street. Unfortunately, that's the way it goes, and the internet has replaced the TV.
Right. I think I remember Bob saying something like, you know, every war is already won or lost before the first shot is fired. And that's because of, you know, the work basically that the propaganda guys or, you know, whoever's working the web or whoever's getting a message out basically turns the tide and wins the thing before you ever see anybody out on the street. And I think that we're going down that road. And again, you know, those guys never get the credit, not even in the history books, but we know who you are, and even if we don't, we appreciate what you do.
And there are some complaints from time to time about consistent messages and other things like that. There's three general complaints, and sometimes it's just from trolls. There's a great deal of attention these days with the Edward Snowden files and everything on professional trolls, and we have a challenge there as well. I've done a podcast on it. No need to dwell on it much, but you can tell when someone's legitimate and illegitimate, usually after enough posts. But, you know, there's a lot of consistent message stuff that drives people crazy, and I think a lot of it comes down to how activists, and I don't care what type of activism it is, when they first get involved in something, they go gung-ho. They really go overboard. They don't turn off. They don't. And that's how all activism works. Bugsters are no different. On the last Don Black show, he talked about certain Stormfronters complaining they were like a cult. But you have to understand that if you're in activism and you have a consistent message loose and people can see that it's working, or at least those activists can, it generally feeds on itself, the likes of which pro-white groups have never really seen in the past. And so that's a factor, as well as the troll factor. There's also another factor. We don't really want them to turn off most of the time. I mean, if they're only allowed to practice on Stormfront, or they're only allowed to practice on certain sites, because those sites are friendly. Those sites are not necessarily, they're not going to ban them necessarily unless they find out they're actually illegitimate or trolls. But at the same time, the enemy doesn't turn off either. We're not fighting traditional propaganda. We're fighting propaganda matched by a real phenomenon. And the real phenomenon is immigration, integration, force assimilation, and you know the drill. And anytime you see a real phenomenon happening in the real world, backed by real massive anti-white white genocide propaganda the whole way, well, then you're not dealing with propaganda, you're dealing with psychological warfare. And the only way to combat that is you're going to have to get in there, and you're going to have to be just as fanatical, and you're going to have to, there can be no limits to where it can go. The enemy doesn't sit back one morning and say, you know what, this is a Cheerios commercial. I don't think we should promote white genocide and our anti-white stuff in the Cheerios. We shouldn't do that because that's a little over the top. The enemy doesn't do that. The enemy doesn't sit back. They don't say, you know what? This is a commercial, a children's commercial in the middle of a children's cartoon. I don't think we should hold, I think we should hold back on our garbage here. And don't do that. Psychological warfare is global. It's all encompassing. It's in all white countries. It's in every white country. It doesn't stop at the Disneyland level, the kids level. It doesn't stop at the adult level. There are nothing off limits to our enemy's psychological warfare. So in some ways, having the berserkers out there, that's what I call most bugsters when they first get involved, berserkers, is incredibly handy. It's what's got us this far because it feeds on itself, and they don't have any limits for good reason. The enemy doesn't. The enemy doesn't stop and turn off or tune down. They don't do that. And to win, to actually neutralize psychological warfare, that's what it takes. Most of pro-whites are interested in education. But you can't educate without discussion. You can't have discussions in the presence of psychological warfare. Because as soon as you make a breakthrough, the person that you make a breakthrough with turns around and guess what they get hit with? Psychological warfare. So it's a chain reaction. You might be great around getting, well, I don't need, say anti-racism is a code word for anti-white. I can get around that. I'm good with words. Well, guess what? You're probably the only one in your area that is good with words. It's unduplicatable. And as soon as you teach someone to do that, they can't duplicate it. They get hit with the same psychological warfare. The point is, with psychological warfare present, until you combat that, you ain't going nowhere. You can't go anywhere. You're stuck. So I love the Bugs Berserkers. I think it's great that they're out there. Sometimes maybe they are a little overzealous, but all activists are overzealous, especially if they see something working.
Right.
The enemy is likewise overzealous.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think our guys are overzealous. A lot of times,
That was Don Black's complaint. He was that certain Stormfronters called him cults, but I think nothing has power over understanding. I don't think most of the pro-white side even understand what they're up against. They think it's just propaganda. They think it's just massive media control. It has nothing to do with media control. It's whether or not you're using your media to control the message. If you use pro-white websites to control the message, you're going to be in a pretty good position with signs getting thrown up all over the place. So, I mean, if you use media to control the message, that's what makes the media work. That's what makes the media work in your favor or against us. Our enemy uses the media to control the message.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you know, when you're changing people's perspective, you're changing people's worldview, and you're doing that with those talking points, and not just the anti-whites or the, you know, people who are sitting on the fence or the average Joe out there, you're changing the way white nationalists see the world. And when that happens, people don't like change. They're a little bit resistant, but after a while they do adjust to it, and that's the way the stuff works. So don't ever be discouraged because, you know, someone says, well, you're being a little too shrill. Hey, you know, that's your job. And eventually, after a while, they're like, well, you know, it's a pretty good message. And
most activists go gung-ho, then they start learning to moderate things. But activists generally don't learn to moderate things. And I don't care whether it's environmental activism or even the average listener is going to be like this when they first get involved. This stuff can really feed on itself. I got an email from a bugster not long ago. And that he was kind of going through a little low patch. He was a little tired, this stuff gets exhausting. All activism gets exhausting. And he never really pushed anything on his family. His family hears him say it and everything else, but he doesn't walk around teaching his children or anything like that. But his daughter, who was very young, stood up in front of 600 people and started talking, basically using the talking points. That's cool. And she got suspended for a couple days for doing so. But her father has never been more proud of her, simply because she picked up on it.
Right. Oh. You know, she
basically defended herself.
That's huge. How old did you say she was?
She's in junior high, I believe.
My goodness, she just ripped the heart out of the anti-whites. I mean, right. You have a little girl do that? My goodness.
Yeah, it was. I don't want to go into too many details, but basically they suspended her for a couple days. They may have just put her into detention or however that goes for a couple days until they could meet with her father and stuff like that. And her father was, you know, pretty happy. He didn't know what his daughter had done, and then they called him in there like, you know, where's this anti-racism as a code word for anti-white? She said that this is all just a multiculturalism is just an anti-white genocidal scam, and she did the whole entire mantra.
Right.
And he's never taught it to her. I mean, she hears him on message,
yeah,
and he will sit here and grind it into her head, make her memorize things. So he was actually shocked that she would stand up and do that.
That's beautiful.
And I'm like, no, that's how things work. Consistent messages are duplicatable. That's why we call them consistent messages. I mean, you know, when you hear all the people from Obama saying, oh, well, yes, we can, and that type of stuff, it's duplicatable. 5-year-old can do it. A kid in junior high can do it. And a person that's 90 years old can do it. That's what makes it, you know, a consistent message. But that's the type of amplification you start getting around society, and that's what works. It works in unexpected ways.
Well, and, you know, Horace, I hear people say, well, you know, maybe we should tone it down. Maybe we should be a little bit more subtle. And other people say, no, we should be in their face. And my answer is yes. Yes to both. You know, I mean, you hit this from many, many different angles, and as long as you're using the talking points, you can't lose. Be subtle, be in your face.
I think you learn to preach to your audience, not to the choir, and there's some times for both, I think. I think ultimately you got to play to your personality. If you play to your personality, like this guy's personality is not to make his kids memorize stuff, obviously. Well, he played to his personality and made a big impact on his family, and now you have a little white girl defending herself, which is what she should be doing verbally. Verbally defending herself,
right?
To such an extent that it caused absolute mayhem.
yeah. I mean, and that's a home run. And you know, sometimes you hit home runs, sometimes you hit singles, sometimes you just bunt the ball. But
the point I'm trying to make is there's a whole lot of stuff going on there that the average listener has no idea of because maybe you're not in the Catberg seat. Most of you don't get the emails. I talk about this stuff from time to time, but that was one of the more interesting emails I've gotten the last month. But this stuff like this comes in all the time. This stuff is all over the place.
Man, I would love to have a video of that.
Yeah, no one had a video of it. But yeah, that would have been great. I don't know that her father... Well, I don't know. I don't know. I don't really know a whole lot about this. You never know what's coming in. But, you know, I do believe it's a legitimate story because the individual has been a long-time listener. And he was really surprised that his daughter could do the whole entire mantra and all the basic talking points to answer the question as the teacher started answering. Actually, the shocked responses and whatnot, because she had heard him do it so many times.
Sure.
So I thought that, well, it's not uncommon for a kid to pick up things from their parents. She knew what to say when she was called a racist. That's for sure.
Children are little sponges, man. They learn by imitation. You take a little baby, he learns how to smile by seeing you smile. And
what surprised him, I think he wasn't surprised that it actually rubbed off on her. He was surprised that she would actually confront, because she's a pretty shy kid, a whole auditorium full of other kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
And many other kids afterwards, even older ones or whatnot, like, you know, wow, that was pretty impressive. I didn't know to say that when I'm called a racist. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't know what to say, really. White people in the same position.
The way kids are, some of the others will pick up on it and use the same talking points. I mean, especially at that age, if something works, if something's cool, boy, other kids pick up on it instantly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure.
You know, Horace, getting to tactics too, along the same lines of what I was saying earlier, that you can't hardly go wrong. You know, you can't adjust to different environments and everything. But I was talking tactics with a guy earlier this week about the White Man March. You know, and one fellow was saying, "Well, I like this flash march idea. I like these flash mob ideas." And the other guy is saying, "Well, you know, I think that you have to stake your ground and hold your position and let the bad guys come at you and address them or whatever." And my answer was yes. You know, it's not either or. It depends on the environment. It depends on the circumstances. You know, be creative, you know, plan on winning and take a winning strategy to whatever environment you're going into. But the only way you can really fail is by doing nothing.
Yeah, our race really respond. Our race is, especially the pro-white side, are so used to being exposed to closed-in type of thinking, meaning that everything's rigid and the rules are that here's a consistent message, there are no rules. That kind of goes against the orthodoxy of what they've been taught, you know, or what they've been scheduled into believing works. you know, let's do this particular thing at this particular date and all show up with signs. Well, all of the above.
Right.
Do what works for you, and if you have everyone working toward their what works for their own personality, their own strengths and weaknesses, it works a lot better than some type of rigid structure, some type of structure that our opponents would use. White genocide is a closed system. It's all white countries. It's only white countries. You know, they're not fighting racism in they're not fighting racism on the moon or in China or in Saudi Arabia. They're fighting it here because it's just a code word for anti-white. You know, this is a very, very much a closed system. And the way we're approaching it is exposing it for what it is. At the same time, we use open system style tactics, which the internet basically caters to.
Oh, yeah, and open system stuff is what wrecks a closed system. You know, a closed system has to stay closed or it doesn't work anymore. And I think one of the, you know, when we get to tactics and stuff like that, the only guidance or rule I'd say, besides, you know, don't break any laws because that's not, you know, beneficial right now, but the other thing I would say is be proactive. Don't react. Don't wait until the opposition comes. Go out there and poke them, and then stand back and let them rage for a while, and then go poke them somewhere else. And don't be proactive. Don't just wait for things to happen. And as long as you're proactive, you can hardly lose.
Yeah, this type of closed system we're in, the system we'll label it white genocide. The what I call the anti-white proposition that it's made up with. You know, there can be no all-white countries anywhere, and there can be no all-white areas in the formerly all-white countries. You know, this extreme proposition that we call white genocide that they push for night and day, it has to really encompass the whole entire planet. If anyone were to break away at any given day, it would be over with.
Oh, yeah.
The Soviet Union has to conquer the planet. Our enemy operates like a closed system. The neoconservatives, you see it, they have to conquer the planet. That's what's going on right now with Russia. If they don't, you're in trouble.
Yeah, that's
it's all or nothing. They're insane, but this is the way that this is the thinking behind these type of systems that they develop. This closed system has to be at war with everything, and it has to conquer everything. Because if someone breaks through, it can't work. It doesn't work.
Yeah,
in other words, if Australia declares itself a pro-white homeland, I don't think it's going to happen, but if it happened tomorrow, it's over with. Everything collapses.
Or even if there was some, you know, couple counties in the United States that decided they wanted to stay white, you know, that would be unacceptable. Obviously there's counties in the U.S. that are mostly black or mostly Mexican. That's fine. There's counties in black countries that are all black. But if you have counties in a white country that want to stay white, that wrecks their entire system. And one of the reasons why is you hit a very good word there a second ago, Horace, is it's a kind of insanity. It's a madness. And, it's like a mental disorder that increases with time. And so, you know, what was acceptable back 10, 20 years ago, you know, for someone to have a little bit of difference with political correctness or something, today the orthodoxy, the closed system gets tighter and tighter and tighter, and if there's any hole in it, the whole thing's gonna break loose. And so, you know, it really makes our job pretty easy. You know, we don't have to counter them on every point or anything like that. We just have to point out a simple inconsistency that it's all white countries and only white countries that are being forced assimilated. And just by hitting this one little point, it'll break the whole thing wide open.
Yes, that's what was done in the Soviet Union in a variety of different ways across a platform called Samizdat, an open system style platform, is they basically push for a public discussion.
Right.
On this workers' paradise that needed guards and machine guns to keep people from leaving. And that's what we're following the same template, and the stuff works. The template works almost identical, frame by frame. It's just a lot faster because we're dealing with something like the internet and not dealing with copying machines or an old Samizdat-style printing press. We're dealing with, I guess you could call it a printing press that they first printed those up on. But you're dealing with something radical form of new technology which helps push things along. But if there ever is a public discussion on white genocide, it's over with.
That's the thing. That's all we have to do is provoke the conversation, because the system cannot even allow a conversation. That, you know, much less winning or losing that conversation. They can't even allow the conversation to take place on whether if these, you know, these tactics are genocidal if they're used against anybody else. And if you just say, well, it would also be genocidal if it was used against white people.
The only discussions allowed are within the frame of the anti-white perspective. if a discussion goes out of bounds, out of the bounds of the anti-white perspective, the system itself is in trouble. Whether it be the history, it's row by row by row. What we believe is white genocide is the keystone that holds the thing together.
Right. Right. And again, you know, if there's any questioning of the political correctness, which is essentially kind of an insane religion, then the whole thing falls apart. And, you know, a lot of even the white nationalists will get sucked into working within their paradigm, you know, arguing their points, reacting to accusations they make. You know, you can do that all day long. It's not going to break the closed system because you're working within it. But as soon as you step outside that closed system and you say, well, you know, there's a white genocide going on, how, you know, are you pro-white or are you pro-white genocide? You've just changed the entire paradigm.
Yeah. Yeah, another way to do it is to actually keep as soon as someone has an anti-white perspective or as soon as someone gives an anti-white point of view, you just point out to them, well, you're speaking from the anti-white perspective. You're speaking from the anti-white point of view. And just let it sit there and percolate a little bit.
You know, that is a really good tactic. I mean, you mentioned that to me before, and I have not put it into use yet, but that's something I need to get familiar with.
Well, if that's someone acting in that politically correct robotic mindset, you just say, well, from the anti-white perspective, sure. Just play along with, yeah, you know, Asia for the Asia, Africa for Africa, white country for everybody. You know, it's from the anti-white perspective, yes. From the anti-white point of view. You're speaking from the anti-white point of view. Just keep calling them an anti-white in a very polite way.
Understood.
And it starts grating.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of times what they're going to try to do is someone that's good, maybe if you're not good at really speaking or you're not that aggressive, this type of tactic works very well because someone's going to try to take advantage of you and try to be very pushy and blah, 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 blah. You know, it's nothing but a bunch of anti-white blahs. You're like, yeah, from the anti-white perspective. Yes, from the anti-white point of view. You're speaking from the anti-white point of view. Just keep calling them an anti-white in a polite way, and you'll keep training the conversation. It'll get very frustrating for them.
Gotcha. So,
and then you hit them with a talking point here or there once you do that about 5 or 6 times.
So whenever they make their case, you just say, well, I mean, that might make sense if you're coming from an anti-white position.
Exactly.
You know,
that's another way to put it, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, obviously white genocide is an issue, but I can see that you're coming from an anti-white position, and that would make sense within that anti-white paradigm.
Yeah, and I ask them an iron question, you know, do you agree with the, I usually say, so you agree with the anti-white proposition. What's the anti-white proposition? Well, there could be no all-white countries anywhere, and there can be no all-white areas within the confines of those formerly all-white countries. Do you agree with this extreme proposition? Usually it says, well, it is extreme. There could be no all-white countries anywhere. But that's the proposition.
Understood.
And that is white genocide. That's the whole conundrum. We put a phrase on it, but it is the anti-white proposition. And so you just ask them if they agree with it. And it's pretty hard to agree with that. It's pretty extreme, but that's what really they're agreeing with. Many times in anti-whiteism or when someone's basically supporting their own genocide, sometimes without even realizing what they're doing, on a mental level, they're just programmed. That starts hitting home pretty aggressively, and they don't know how to respond to it. But yeah, you can take some passive or very active approaches, but it usually revolves asking questions and making statements, you know, from the anti-white point of view, from the anti-white perspective.
Right. Right. Well, you know, this is why I listen to your show, Horace, because you teach me things like this. And I talk on Don Black's show 5 days a week, but I really need to brush up on some of these skills and put these things into effect.
That is something you can do in public all the time from a passive standpoint. You're calling an opponent anti-white without calling them an anti-white. It's going to start grating on them, and it'll take a few times for them to even realize what you're doing, and they might not realize it till well after, depending on how programmed they are. But you keep on asserting, yeah, you're from the anti-white perspective, sure.
Right. Yeah.
You know, there could be no all-white areas.
Well, you know, I could use that even on Don's show, you know, when we're discussing things and we don't have an anti-white on the show with us. But, you know, a lot of the news stories we go over and things like that, you know, they exist and they make sense only within the anti-white paradigm. And if you just note that as you're going through things.
Yep. Yeah, it's so ideal. Well, we always frame stuff between pro-whites and anti-whites. I'm always asked all these typical questions that white nationalists and pro-whites historically have asked. What do you think about this? What do you think about this philosophy, doctrine, whatever? At the educational level, the discussions about national socialism or socialism to the historical paradigm in America, which isn't towards socialism but can be very pro-white, there's all kinds of different historical discussions going on at the educational level. At the psychological warfare level, doesn't matter to me. You're either pro-white or anti-white. If you're pro-white, that's fine. Go have a discussion, whatever. But in my world, that the only thing that exists when I evaluate someone is whether they're pro-white or anti-white. Until we're out of psychological warfare, nothing else really makes sense because you can't really have a discussion. And the discussion is always only confined to pro-whites anyway, so what's the point?
Well,
but that is a traditional bugster kind of mentality. You know, you're either pro-white or anti-white. So it's very important to keep calling people that are anti-white, anti-white.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, the bugsters are like a laser focusing in and pushing everybody to that decision point. And then also on Follow the White Rabbit shows like we're doing right now, it's all practical politics. Now, again, when you're doing like a radio show or you're just having a conversation with the average Joe, you've got to mix it up. You've got to keep it interesting. You know, on Don's show, we're going to be talking about different white nationalist philosophies and everything. But I still think you can integrate in the anti-white versus pro-white perspective in almost anything that you're talking about. You know, you can talk about news stories, you can talk about different philosophies, you can have different guests on, but at the same time, the practical politics can be worked in there and keep you on track, and I hope to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, well, it's all a, you know, it's all a trend we're on. I always talk about trends, you know, but the trend is toward this message getting louder and louder. And, there's no holding it back. There's nothing I can do to stop it. They're not going to stop and not do it because Truck Roy says not to, or because I say not to. It doesn't really work that way.
It's out of the box now.
Yeah, it's the 900-pound white rabbit running across the planet, and that's good. That's what we want. You don't want it to be personality dependent, because if you are, well, the system's used to fighting big personality dissidents with books. And the system's used to, you know, you've got a soldier or a knight standing with a lance and a sword against a dragon, you know, the classic matchup.
Mano a mano.
This type of system smashes those knights into a million pieces. However, this type of system is vulnerable. It's vulnerable to its own contradictions. It's vulnerable to 1,000 little pokes getting poked again over and over again. A bunch of little pokes with little needles over and over again at the conversation level in this type of society. You know, it gets to this such an extent that you're not really looking for some type of mass. You're not really looking for the masses per se, but there's a core percentage that makes every country run. And as soon as that core percentage starts questioning the leadership, starts questioning the paradigm, and we are gearing for that core percentage all across Western civilization, it's probably not more than 10 or 15%. But as soon as they start having problems run through their mind, well, then, and that question, of course, comes down to loyalty, then the society, civilization becomes impossible to run effectively. And then the elites are in trouble. And that's kind of what we're seeing, in my opinion, all across Western civilization. Things are getting more and more difficult to run.
You know, when I was always imagining how the world worked, I always imagined that there were elites up there that cared about us and that, you know, we just keep our heads down and do our thing and they'll eventually come and save us. But, you know, I think you're right. It's not going to be some big knight or some big presidential candidate that's going to slay the dragon. It's going to be a thousand little people like us just laughing at the system, making little pokes at it, a little junior high girl, you know, calling out her whole class and podunk, you know, America or whatever. I think a thousand of those is going to take it down.
Well, there's more and more pro-whites operating within this system every single day. Every single day, more and more get fed up. The challenge is the thing that you have to understand if you're outside of the system. And of course, when you start talking about the government, I don't care whether you're talking about the German government, the U.S. government, the Spanish government, the government's huge. Huge. For one, most of those people can't say anything. They just got to do things. And most of them are in total war every single day themselves. So, you know, when you start talking about people within the confines of the system, well, they're at war too. They're at war too. A little bit different kind of war, but they're generally at war every day with different departments or this or that or so on and so forth. But with a consistent message loose, it starts breaking open all kinds of interesting avenues.
Yeah, you know, I we had a guest on the other show, on Don's show here last week that works deep within corporate America.
And for those of you that don't know, let me cut in here. Don Black and Truck Roy are on Rents.com. That's Rents Broadcasting.
Yeah.
They have a morning show there that runs from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time, isn't that right?
Yeah, Rents Radio I'm on for the first hour, and then Don's usually on with a guest or another co-host for the second hour. And one of our guests that came on is a longtime Stormfront that I've known for years, works deep within corporate America, and I've been fortunate enough from my perspective that I haven't had to deal with all the, you know, the diversity department, the human resources and all that. You know, I've kind of been a truck driver, and I kind of, you know, one-man show, little outside the system ways of making money. But for the people that are deep within the system, of course, the guys that work within the governmental agencies and the law enforcement and everything else, you know, it's like the sort of political correctness that you got in junior high times 10. And these guys are in the system. They're under tremendous pressure. And it's not surprising that you see one of them pull Edward Snowden once in a while. But there's a whole lot more of them that are just kind of dragging their feet and trying to strangle this thing from the inside.
Yeah, there's going to be all kinds of interesting stuff that comes out. Of course, we only know who's there if they're visibly fighting. As a consistent message gets more and more live, you're going to see more and more of it. But typically, there are massive fights going on within the top of Western civilization now. I mean, if anyone, all you have to do is look up bankster deaths. You know, there's all kinds of crazy stuff happening. They're killing each other, in my opinion. But there's all kinds of crazy stuff happening. And, And generally speaking, what I'm saying is these different factions that I've long talked about within the confine of our enemy even are at war. They're at war.
Well, before we end the show here, man, are you going to grace us with a little geopolitical analysis on the Ukraine and Russia?
Well, what we're seeing is something that I've talked about for now going back a few plus years and Follow the White Rabbit, and that relationship between our elites and this Russian bear are coming to a head. And they've decided that after last fall they tried to get things going in Syria, they tried to go to war in Syria, and they, of course, Putin stopped them. And now they've decided that if you want to get a war going, or if you're going to do anything in Syria, you better confront Russia first. So there are some that believe that they're just trying to tie him down. There are others, and I'm going from Putin's statement himself, going back to 2011, if you remember, this guy said, quote-unquote, based on official Russian documents, that told his generals to prepare for Armageddon, to prepare for an apocalypse. So I laugh because it's scary, but counter that with his statement he made in New York Times. He wrote a statement to the American people comparing the United States to Old Testament chosen, and they're more looking toward a New Testament view, which is kind of rare for him to get apocalyptic now. With the moves that we've just seen happen, hindsight sometimes, you know, vision's always 20/20, but it lends itself to the truth. They're prepared for something. You're not going to catch them off guard. What they're prepared for may be pretty scary. I don't know. I don't know what these guys in charge are planning on doing. The trends converging are towards some type of very large war. China's also gearing up for it. Have been for years. We'll have to see.
I've noticed that the U.S. and Western Europe have been expanding NATO ever since the fall of the Soviet Union further and further east. It's getting to the point where it's kind of ridiculous when they're bringing in places like Belarus or Georgia or something
like
that.
One of the dark horses behind President Obama's name, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and what he's talked about is two things: that the Council of Foreign Relations, his son talked to, and his son carries the same opinion as him, with former Senator John Edwards, had talked about using the far right as, well, he's talked about it himself, using the far right as a subversion tactic into the Eastern Bloc countries to try to wage war against Russia, some type of asymmetrical war in Russia. Because it doesn't matter whether it's gays or Jews or, you know, there's a certain element at the top of Western civilization that will subvert whatever it is there's there to use to subvert. The far right, you know, goes back to World War II, although it generally blows up in their face. And so there's been a lot of discussions about their particular tactics, but that would be well known to Vladimir Putin. He's not stupid. He might be a lot of things. Stupid's not one of them. And then, of course, you know, they've always accused him of being like a neocon. Vladimir Putin disguises his Russian nationalism under this type of universalist Eurasianism post-2008. Alexander Dugin. And they've accused him of being, and neocons, of course, are Jewish supremacists who disguise everything under this globalist, neocon, democracy, is happy horse nonsense. They're accusing him of being the same thing, which is kind of interesting. That's something we can either prove or disprove. Obviously, many of the Russian listeners don't like Vladimir Putin's policies inside, because his policies, well, everyone at the top of Western civilization and Russia would, are susceptible to being called anti-white because of policies they support. Russia, Putin's no different internally. Maybe not as extreme as of yet. And of course, maybe it's just the Russian nationalist backlash, but he's the king. I consider him the king of anti-subversion. It doesn't matter whether you're coming from the far right. They draw a circle around their groups, and if you try to penetrate that from the far right, far left, gay, pussy, he's going to lock you down. It doesn't really matter whether you're from London or whether you're from a Russian nationalist group. You're either in his group or you're an enemy, and that's kind of an anti-subversion mindset that's been very effective. But they're bringing this to a head, and I'm interested in whether or not they're just trying to get a war going in the Middle East and they've got to try to bog him down, or whether they're really going to go at it. They're really going to try to cause chaos in and around Russia in hopes that he doesn't step it up, because they've pretty much reformulated all Russian forces into these fast reaction type brigades, I believe they call them, and I don't know what the phrase is in Russia, but we saw it in effect in Georgia very effectively. But one of the challenges with these brigades, if these rapid attack groups, rapid response groups we're seeing from Russia, ever start losing ground, the Russian strategy post a few years back at least has been very overt. Their backup strategy is to go tactical nuke.
Right.
Which is very scary.
Right.
They're not going to lose, in other words. They're not going to lose or play nice. And China, of course, has a very similar strategy. And we've got all these giant floating ships around the planet, floating coffins, probably. And we've got the whole planet, regardless of what people hear on Fox News, that hates us. They don't want us there.
You know, one of the things that's piqued my interest in the last couple of weeks is story after story popping up in my paper about Cossacks. And, you know, we haven't seen Cossacks in 100 years. And
yeah, Putin, or elements of Putin is a group. They're a group, and that group, by and large, goes into Germany as well, because he speaks German, especially when you get into former East German bloc. It's a very interesting group behind Putin. You got to remember, the Germans saved him. In St. Petersburg, when he was first in trouble as mayor of St. Petersburg and an operative there, the German businesses saved him. They could have let him go under. They saved his tail in St. Petersburg. And so there's always a German element there, and I'm not talking necessarily about Merkel, but I'm talking about some type of element there, some type of network, if you will, behind him. And that network, and Putin has been very vocal in bringing back the Cossack.
Yeah, and the Cossacks, I mean, they're, obviously a lot of different things, but they're nothing if not anti-Semitic. And it's interesting to me, I opened up my paper yesterday, and on the picture, on the paper, they got, Ukrainian police actually with Cossacks. Again, where did these Cossacks come from? I know they've existed as a group, but not as a military police force. And they are assisting the police in hauling out a feminist protester or something like that. And so whether it's in the Ukraine and with the military and police in the Ukraine, or it's the military and police in Sochi, you see these Cossacks, which are just kind of like civilian militia guys coming
well,
in.
Well, actually, there's an official policy in Russia, and I don't know how it applies to Ukraine, but there's been an official policy all across Russia in regards to bringing back the Cossack, and it has to do with it. I don't know what the term is, but some of these guys are like deputized and stuff like that, and local police. It's a very interesting thing that they brought back, and a lot of people are just now paying attention to it simply because if you've seen them whip the Pussy Riots, and some people think that was staged or not, I think they would actually whip the Pussy Riots if you allowed them to. But they went at it at the Olympics. They were there at the Olympics, and they've become very interesting in these protest movements. But that is something that the parties behind Putin have been single-handedly bringing them back. Now, as far, I don't know of any anti-Semitic incidents involving them of late. That would be all over the place.
Well, I mean, historically,
yeah.
Yeah, historically, I mean, they are, the Jews' worst nightmare. But it's interesting because if you go back...
Well, the Jewish tax collectors' worst nightmares.
Right. And back in history in America, obviously militias and citizens taking law enforcement into their domain was a big part of America in the early colonial times and the Wild West and everything like that. And, of course, that inspires a lot of nationalism to have have your police and your citizens on the same page, working together, fighting against common enemies, be it corrupt politicians or mobsters or whatever. And, of course, America today is there's a very different dynamic. You know, there's the police and then there's the rest of us. And there's kind of this, you know, if you're one of the authorities, you have a separate set of rules. And if you're one of the citizens, you better kiss butt to the authorities. And it's demoralizing for a population. I can't think of something that would bring the morale of a population up better than to integrate them into law enforcement and into taking care of some of the dissident elements in your population.
Well, you're either going to, if you go back in America in the 50s and even before World War II, if you're not going to stop subversion, and that's what Putin, that if you study Putin, forget about all the everything else people call them. We know for a fact he's amazing at anti-subversion. You're going to have a lot of tools and tactics like that. I mean, the scary stuff is this is coming to a head. I assumed it would come to a head across the Middle East, but he has a lot of tools at his disposal. In spite of what they say on Fox News, you're not going to be confronting them very easily without paying a serious cost. And I do understand what the Zionist side of the equation, the globalist side, I call them Team Pink Rabbit. I understand what they understand, that his confrontation in Ukraine, and now, of course, this is phase two, a lot closer to Europe than Georgia, has the potential to bring apart NATO and to bring apart the EU all at the same time. In my opinion, that's what certain elements in Europe actually want. And those elements are, of course, probably would be very friendly to us long term. You know, on one side, you've got Germans, Merkel will run her mouth, then other elements in Germany will drag their feet on sanctions. It's been like this within NATO. They'll make up an excuse. Oh, we can't do that because of World War II. We can't intervene. We can't do this. We can't do that. So they'll drag their feet. Then, of course, some other German politician will be gung-ho. The whole entire thing, what happens? Nothing gets done. And meanwhile, you got this Russian bear running around doing whatever it wants to do, basically. So really, you know, it's now coming to a head, basically. And I'm interested to see, obviously, how this all works out. It's quite a lot of dangerous stuff going on. In the last week, for those that are into military technology, Russia has tested successfully its fifth-generation fighter jet, which many believe is out there flying already, but they've successfully publicly made it known that it's been tested and out flying. And that's their equivalent to the F-22, which is Russians have the tendency to get very interesting things done on the cheap, very effective, kind of like AK-47-style stuff. But they're doing a fifth-generation fighter to oppose ours, and supposedly it's flying successfully. Another thing they did in the past week, which actually surprised me, is they brought out the S-500. The S-500 is their air defense. And this one is not only air, but it's air and space defense. It's a crazy upgrade from the S-400. It covers a tremendous amount of territory. And so on March 3rd, they tested that successfully or brought it out or starting to roll the thing out. And we don't know what's out there, of course, until white rabbits all approach military the same way. We don't know about stealth fighters until they bomb someone. So Russia's got a lot of surprises that are now rolling out, which is very dangerous. We obviously don't want wars on the border of Europe, but that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to cause trouble, obviously.
All right. Well, I think I'm going to have to stay tuned to your podcast, Horace. I haven't listened to it for a little while, and I've got to get back into the loop.
Well, what we're doing is following trends, but those trends are now coming to a head, and it all has everything to do with white genocide, in our opinion. It's one of the biggest overwhelming trends in this trend toward globalism. But I don't know if they can get a war going or not. We'll have to see. They're trying awful hard from the looks of it.
It's all interlinked.
Yes, it is. But this is Horace Devenger. You listen to Horace Devenger's Follow the White Rabbit with the infamous Minnie Irva and Truck Roy. And we look forward to seeing the White Man March on March 15th. Get out there, you know, think globally, but act locally. Do something, whether it be online, offline, all of the above. Maybe you're out there on the street with a smartphone. You know the drill. Just get it done. Just always play by the rules and the law. Never break them. That's the nature of this game. And we'll be back with you with another Foul White Rabbit sometime in the near future. Any last words, Truck Roy?
Glad to be here and looking forward to hearing some more geopolitical analysis on your show.
Yeah, we'll be back with you. Endgame Exotica broadcasts 6 times a week generally. So we'll be back with you soon, one way, shape, manner, or form.
All right. You want me to go ahead and let's see, stop my recording here. Pause.
White Rabbit Radio.